The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Welcome to the EMS Educast. We're so glad you're here. We have one of the stars of our first 50 season or 50 episodes. We've done more than 50 episodes already, and the show that garnered the most listeners, the most downloads and impressions, was episode 33 when Kelly Grayson joined us to talk about the airway management continuum concept that he teaches. So if you haven't heard that one, make sure you go back to the archives and give it a listen. And tonight, Kelly's joining Bill and Rob and I, and we're going to be talking about conferences, EMS conferences. But before we introduce Kelly further or launch right into the show, I'll just remind you that I'm Greg Fries, one of the co-hosts. Really enjoy this every week. Chugging along with my other podcast, The Medical Author Chat. If you haven't listened to that yet, please do. I actually think Kelly's episode of The Medical Author Chat is also the most listened to episode there. So he's what keeps our podcast alive, so we're thrilled to have him back.
You're laying it on so thick.
Well, it's partly true, just a small bit. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm jovial. You know, I've gotten 3 bike rides in this week, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday.
Wow.
And you, a couple episodes ago, we talked about fitness. How are you doing?
Well, I just got the bikes out for the first time tonight. We've got some pretty warm weather, so I inflated the tires. My 8-year-old daughter and I went out for a bike ride, so it was great.
Awesome. Helmets? Wearing your helmets?
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you use a road ID?
I don't.
I'll send you I got a gift card. I'll send it to you.
Okay.
You'll check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes for other people if they want to know what road ID is.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we love biking. Great activity. Bill? Sorry, Rob.
Does that hold up from being squished? Is that the idea? Is it kind of like a black box when you're eviscerated on the pavement? Is that?
It's a little bit lower tech, but the one I use, it's just a Velcro band that goes around my wrist, and it's got my name and phone number and my wife's name on it. So if I were to have a medical emergency or be hit by a car, EMS could notify my wife that I'm on my way to the hospital. You can get a higher tech version where it's got like a 800 number, and you call that phone number, and then the road ID answering person would be like, yeah, that's Rob, and you know he's allergic to morphine, and he's already had a plate put in his forehead, so don't put another one in. Or
it'll be, this is Rob, he needs morphine or fentanyl, you know, alternatively.
But,
not fussy.
You know, it's actually it's a good thing to just a little reminder as the seasons change here. If you know, I hear this from the medic alert tag people as well as road ID, is that always a reminder to EMS professionals, if you have a John or Jane Doe, look for identification. Might be a piece of jewelry or a bracelet or something like that.
And I have ice on my cell phone, too.
Hey, there you go.
There you go.
What kind of cell phone are you using?
You know, it's the old clamshell thing, something, LG, I think it is.
Okay.
Antique.
Yeah, it's time for an upgrade there, Rob.
Yeah.
Well, when you get that iPad, you can just put that in your back pocket.
That's right. I'm looking for a holster for the iPad.
Yeah. You put install Skype on your iPad and you'll be good to go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bill, enough of this silliness. Help get us back on track here.
Well, good evening, and it's good to be here. This is Bill Toon, another one of the hosts, and it's always enjoyable to be here. And Rob, I could probably listen to the two of you banter back and forth and laugh hysterically the entire time while I'm here.
Well, I like to keep it short. I got to keep it short now because apparently my colleagues think I'm long-winded. So I'm,
and they're right.
I'm going to try and speak in staccato now. Just, you know, one word right. sentences.
Right, right. Yeah. Starting. Let's see how that. No. Yeah, starting when. But nope, I'm looking forward to tonight's discussion, and I'm up to my elbows. Getting ready to head to Seattle this weekend for the Resuscitation Academy all next week. And as Rob alluded to earlier, I'm in the midst of a final draft of my dissertation that has to be submitted no later than next Friday. So I'm up to my elbows in work. And and then I have this thing called a job, and they want me to do stuff too.
Gosh. Send me a chapter of that dissertation, and I'll work on it for you. What's right. your topic? What's
Don't
your
let topic? Professor hear that.
Yeah. What's your topic, Bill?
Character development within higher education.
Okay.
Well, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have you on a show in the future to defend your dissertation.
Wait till they do it to me, and then I'll be more than glad to be defended.
Does electroconvulsive therapy play into that at any point?
If I can hook the members of my panel up to it and use it to make them forget the entire oral and just pass me. Yes, that will be fine.
Yeah. Taser use and teaching the affective domain.
There you go. And that voice, ladies and gentlemen, was Mr. Kelly Grayson. Kelly, I know you're on the road. Can you divulge your location?
Yeah, I'm in Nebraska. I'm speaking at Nebraska's instructor conference tomorrow and their spring EMS conference Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So
awesome. Do us a favor and tell all those instructors to listen to the EMS Educast. As far as I know, we have more than 2 and less than 100 listeners from Nebraska. So we need more.
Mercilessly.
All right. So, Kelly, tonight's topic is about conferences, EMS conferences mm-hmm. specifically, and you were at the EMS Today conference mm-hmm. earlier this month, and you wrote a blog post just about your thoughts of what was on the agenda, yeah. and I know you travel all over the world speaking at EMS conferences, and why don't you just sort of lay out for us your blog post about the EMS Today mm-hmm. and sort of you know, where conference programs have gone more generally in recent history.
How, I bit the hand that fed me to a certain extent. I'm a member of the GEMS EMS and Fire blog network, and I made a comment how, in my opinion, the educational content at EMS Today was getting kind of stale. And it's, I don't know that it's stale, for the average attendee, and I made pointed that out in my post that if you only attend one conference a year or one conference every few years, conferences like EMS Expo and EMS Today offer a lot of bang for your buck to hear nationally known speakers and interesting topics. The problem is if you attend this conference every year, you tend to see the same faces over and over and over again. Now, I understand that, you know, some of these guys they book are because they're that good, and AJ made that point in his reply to my post that they book guys like Tim Phelan and Bob Page every year because they could lecture about, you know, the chemical composition of motor oil and make it sound interesting. But if you go to, you know, Expo and EMS Today and the various state conferences, you know, you get a chance to hear Baxter Orman and Mike Smith and Bob Page and several of these other, David Page and others that speak at these things. And as far as the larger EMS conferences go, the two national conferences, I've kind of reached a point of speaker burnout. You know, I've heard a lot of these guys before. And not that they're not very, very good, but, in some cases, some of the stuff that I see them do at EMS Today is not as good as some of their stuff I've seen them do at smaller conferences. And that's my personal opinion, but I think it's gotten kind of stale for the guy that, for the person that is lucky enough to go to multiple EMS conferences.
we need a speaker exchange. Send some Canadians your way, send some Americans this way. Just to mix it up a bit.
Well, and I think part of it is that print media and the conferences that are based on those businesses, you know, Expo is put on by the EMS Magazine people and EMS Today is put on by GEMS. To a certain extent, they still log behind, the social media, disseminating the news of EMS and new things. Most of the time, by the time I see something in one of the national trade magazines, lecture on it at a conference, it's already been discussed and Twitter.
We're getting a bit of Kelly breaking up on us here, going in and out. So I might just fill the void while we see if we can get him back in here.
Well, Greg, I'm going to interrupt there
for a
second. And I want to echo that I believe that if you do go year to year to those couple of national conferences, and I think he described it well, burnout certainly can happen. And I'd also would agree that I have seen some phenomenal presentations that are done at very small EMS conferences and always have been very impressed with the level of enthusiasm that often happens at the state level than at the national level. But I think to be fair to some of those, the people that run the conferences, it is sometimes difficult to find people who can speak to audiences sometimes of that size. And I know that often they take a certain degree of chances because you can put together a call for presentations and people can fill everything out and submit it and it looks very good. But when they actually get there to do their presentation, it's not of the quality that they expected. You know, the person isn't a good presenter in front of people, has very good ideas, is a nice person. They just can't communicate very well in front of the audience. And I think that is, clearly, a big difference that or a challenge that is made by anyone that's trying to develop a conference. So I often think if I was trying to put together a conference, is that recommendations from other conferences, seeing their evaluations, information, you have to really go out when you're dealing with a new lecturer. So I think that that's sometimes why the big conferences deal with people that are known entities and their ability to draw an audience. Kelly, we were just filling in the void for you.
I don't know what point I dropped out, but at some point while I was babbling.
Now, you guys all go to conferences. Do you run into people who are at the conferences specifically to or primarily to scout for guest speakers at their conference? Part of the reason I ask is
some people do that.
Yeah, I was going to say part of the reason I ask is I was at a conference in the fall, and there are two other conferences, one happening in Ottawa next fall, another one happening in Winnipeg next fall as well, and there were groups of people who were organizers for those upcoming conferences, and they were both there scouting for guest speakers for their conferences. I thought that was interesting. I'd never seen that before.
I was scouted by some people from out-of-state conferences last time I spoke in Texas. So, and I'm here in Nebraska based on the recommendation of someone who attended a lecture in Iowa a couple of years ago. So, yeah, they do send out scouts, both formal and informal.
All right, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Great.
Okay.
Sorry about that, everybody.
Okay, sorry about that.
I just got to mix things up every now and then before Rob gets long-winded.
That's it. I'm not saying another word.
Yeah, you know, I've heard of people scouting. I guess I don't feel like I've been scouted yet. I've had a couple people in sessions, I guess, that have said, hey, could you come to our conference? So I guess I was scouted. The other thing that's worked for me lately is the reputation I'm building online, that a couple people have connected with me through the Educast, listening to the Educast, are taking a chance that I'll be good in person, or at least not bad. And I'm actually, Kelly, I'm coming to Louisiana in June to speak at the Louisiana EMT conference. Yes.
What are you going to be speaking about?
One session is going to be about social media and another one about e-learning.
Good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's one of five states I've never been to. So if you're on the line from Alabama, Mississippi, or New Hampshire, Vermont, I'd love to speak at a conference there so I could cross those off my list as well.
Unfortunately, the conference is in June, so crawfish will be out of season, but you'll have to come down here at some point where you can eat boiled crawfish.
Well, the good news is June is when the crawfish season starts in Wisconsin. It's not quite the same.
But y'all use them for bait. Y'all use them for bait. You don't actually eat them, do you?
Some of us have eaten them. Yep. It's a lot of work. They're pretty small. But anyway, Bill, what were you going to add? Get us back on track.
Well, yeah, and I think that I've been reading some of the stuff in the talk show also. I think that something that is you bring up a good point is how are people getting to hear you? And I think let's take that as a stance. If you want to become a speaker at a national conference, what can you do to improve your chances of being selected? And I think that probably one of the easiest things or some things to begin to do is start right at the beginning with your local conferences, and then maybe something at the state level or regional level. Make sure that you ask for the course evaluation feedbacks from the conference people, so you can use those as a way to act as an introduction when you're trying to go to a larger conference. And then I think also the ability now of doing something like a podcast of your presentation, or even videoing your presentation. And I know that once you really go to the larger conference levels, where people are really looking to get to much bigger than anything we do in EMS, that's exactly what they do, is they have a video of them presenting at a conference, so people really can get a sense of what their style is like and how they interact with the audience. And it really depends on how you want to move yourself along. And then it's also getting to know other people who speak within the circuit, the conference circuit is also another way, as you begin to work with them, or if they have an opportunity to hear you. Sometimes who you know can really make a difference of getting you along.
Contacts and referrals are a huge part of it. If you are somewhat of an unknown commodity, it really helps if someone who is trusted by the conference planners, who will give you a good recommendation. And a lot of these guys, share tips, and they'll pass on calls for presentations from conferences you may not know about, and they'll pass those things back and forth amongst themselves. So they're a good resource to cultivate the other speakers at the conference you may be presenting at.
You know, Bill, I've had kind of the opposite experience of, there's I guess the cachet of, like, we're bringing in out-of-state speakers for even small local conferences. I've had better luck speaking at small local conferences in other states than I have in my own state. And case in point, I'm going to Alaska in April and Louisiana and California in June, and I've not had a lot of success here of the different events going on in Wisconsin. And, maybe it's just because they actually know me.
I was going to say, is that because of the definition of an expert is someone from out of town with a slide presentation?
Right. A different accent. So, the other thing that's actually worked well for me too is, when I go to a conference, actually trying to meet whoever it is that selects the speakers, or finding out what the process is, and then making sure I introduce myself to that person. And then finding out, what are you looking for? you know what attendees are looking for. Is there something here that's not being covered? And then if that's an area I can speak on, trying to go for it. You know, it used to be that I would want to speak on, somebody said, come speak on this topic. I would speak on just about anything that somebody would propose. And I've tried to say, well, what over time I've tried to really focus in on and say, okay, these are the things that I'm best at. And if you have a need for one of those at your conference, I'd be happy to come. If you don't, you know, let me know what you're looking for, and maybe Rob or Bill or Kelly or Kyle or Jamie could come and do this presentation for you.
I think you bring up a good point with that. I think that you can become too broad of a lecturer and not necessarily particularly good at a subject matter area, because you'll find that even amongst the Baxter Larmans, the Paul Werfels, and we can continue to run the list, and even if you look at Tim Phelan, he does a very good job when it centers around an area that he truly is an expert in, and that is a lot of stuff dealing with cardiology. But he's built that over so many years now, and he's just has that beautiful blended style that he has a very nice speaking voice, and he can take complex concepts and make them very understandable and build confidence in the person that they actually feel that they can walk out of there and do something with the material. And I think that that's a wonderful art. When you can do that, other people can be, you know, one of the things Baxter Larman, I think, does very well is he is a very credible speaker, but he has a good sense of humor, and he knows how to blend the humor into his presentations. And I can tell you, I have absolutely no sense of humor, so you will almost never see me try to blend humor into any presentation I do, because I'm just not funny.
Well, we'll be the judge of your funniness. Kelly, how do you balance the entertainment versus the need to actually deliver some content that meets the objectives of the session?
Sometimes I don't balance it well. You know, if I have a failing or a weakness as a speaker, sometimes I'll err on the side of injecting too much humor into, and all humor is subjective. You know, you're going to crack a joke at a lecture, and it's going to offend someone. It's pretty much guaranteed. There may be 500 people in the room, and if five were highly offended enough to write bad evaluations, a lot of people pay attention to the five versus the other 495. But I don't know. I try to leaven it. Throughout the lecture, I'll typically open with something funny, a couple of funny little slides. I'll, you know, you guys have heard me talk, you've heard my drawl, and I'll usually play the Southern redneck thing and thicken the drawl just a little bit and tell them, you know, I'm real proud to be up here in Boston, and I just want y'all to know, don't take this the wrong way, but y'all talk kind of funny. I'll stick a funny slide or two at the beginning of the lecture to open it with a laugh, and I'll toss a few in there. But I really tend to I like to put some, you know, a lot of educational content in the lecture and break it down. That's what I take the most joy in, is breaking down a complex subject into fairly digestible bites and doing it with humor. Another speaker you see doing that really, really well is Bob Page. And I kind of go in his mold, even though I was kind of doing things that way before I ever saw him speak about edutainment. That's Bob's term for it. He calls what he does edutainment. I've always said that learning is best accomplished between fits of laughter. And some of my best received stuff is some of the humorous takes on an educational subject, and sometimes it gets you know, PG-13 or R-rated. I've got a shtick I do on cardiology called sex relationships and the cardiac conduction system. I make the point that if you want someone to learn something and commit it to long-term memory, you have to put it in terms that they understand and enjoy, and that means that pretty much everything needs to be couched in terms of food or sex. So I talk about AV blocks disguised as a romantic tale, and how Sidney Sinus and Virginia Ventricle eventually go wrong. So that's just one of the little gigs I do, and then I'll gauge my audience at the beginning and see if they want the PG-13 version or the R-rated version. And so far, I haven't had anyone select the PG-13 one.
Don't you think that I think that what you're really talking on, the same thing with Bob Page when he does this, is it the audience that you're speaking to really gear how you want to blend your sense of humor and the level of jocularity and, you know, riskiness of your discussion? And then also, again, balance that with, are you a funny person or not? Because I do think that people push themselves to be funny when they're not. And as I said, you know, I can clearly see by just some of the things you shared right there that it would capture a certain degree of an audience, and it may turn off another degree of an audience depending upon who you're talking to.
Exactly. Yeah. It's essential that you gauge your audience. You have to be able to read your audience and tailor accordingly. And usually, when I put together a presentation, the first 3 to 4 slides, the introduction, and when I introduce myself and the topic and the objective slide, by the time, 5 minutes, 10 minutes into the lecture, I've gauged the crowd I'm talking to, and I know where I can go with it. Do I make it a little drier and more technical with less of the jocularity, or if they're responding well and we're interacting well, I can keep going in the same vein that I normally do. You have to be able to read your audience from the very beginning, and it takes a lot of time speaking, takes a lot of practice speaking in front of a crowd to develop that, and sometimes it still goes wrong.
Who's your normal audience? Do you normally speak to an EMS crowd, or do you have you had a chance to speak to audience with a larger nursing or physician audience, or what's the blend of type of people you've spoken with?
It's almost exclusively EMS. Now, I will frequently speak to emergency and ICU nurses and physicians to a certain extent. I used to do a regular series of lectures at the family practice residency program at one of our local hospitals called Care and Feeding of Your Paramedic. And then the family practice residents who were doing their ER rotations really liked it, and I got great feedback on it. But I think the people, my kind of humor goes off well with EMS crowds, and I find that I have to dial it back quite a bit if I'm talking to someone other than EMS or emergency care. ER nurses can be a pretty raunchy crowd of people, and lighthearted, and some of the most singularly unhumorous and serious-minded people you'll find, in my experience, are nursing educators. if they haven't practiced clinical nursing in a while and all they do is nursing education, they're very, very not dry, but you can really go wrong with trying to be too funny in front of that crowd. As I found out to my chagrin a couple of years back in South Carolina, where I was almost ran out of the building on a rail because they scheduled the perfect storm of wrong lecture, wrong time, wrong audience. I was speaking at an AHEC conference to what I assumed were a bunch of paramedics, and there were a fair portion of paramedics there, but most of them were public health nurses. And the conference booked me for our comedy routine, which is supposed to be an end-of-the-day, let-your-hair-down, loose and sometimes risque comedy routine, and they booked it for lunch. So, yeah, it was it was I crashed and burned pretty bad. But on the upside, all my clinical topics that I did that were really, really well received. It just EMS poop jokes do not go over well during a lunchtime banquet. Make a note of that.
Especially when meatloaf and mashed potatoes are on the menu.
Yeah, exactly.
The time piece, the scheduling piece is always interesting to me. You know, my preference is always to be like the absolute first breakout session grouping or whatever, but invariably you can end up with some odd times. I did an 8:30 Sunday morning presentation where, you know, I was in this huge room with, I think, 20 people, and the huge room next to me had like 35, and it was just a tough spot. And I always, you know, to some degree you got to march on, but then also I just say, look, like, here we are, like, it's your hour and a half. What do you want to do to make the most of this? And, you know, I think you got to be ready to mix things up a bit as a presenter, just to make sure it's valuable and memorable for the audience.
The just scheduling from the perspective of a conference organizer, scheduling the speakers is a chore in and of itself. I don't envy those people their task of juggling these speakers and their various commitments and putting the right speaker at the right time. I've been lucky enough that I've, with few exceptions, have been booked for slots that, you know, I had good turnout. But I have had those 8:30 in the morning classes on the last day of the conference when everyone is hung over from the big shindig the night before. And I've been surprised. The first time we did the comedy tour was the next to last day of the conference. There was a big party the night before, and it had been a long day, and they booked us in the Grand Ballroom 2 hours after the exhibit hall shut down. And I expected to go over there and, you know, and hear crickets chirping, and we had 2,000 people in the room. It was raucous.
Well, I was going to add, you know, as a conference organizer, you got to be careful how you schedule events that happen sort of outside the conference. I spoke at an EMS Chiefs conference, and they scheduled a golf tournament that same day. So I attended I listened to some of the talks the day before, and there were, you know, rooms full of 60, 70 people. And then the next day when I got to speak, I think there were 15 people in the room. It was.
Yeah. Everybody's. Nursing sunburns and sore muscles.
Do you think there is a danger if, as a speaker, if you're known predominantly for your humor and not for your substance?
Oh yeah. I think there is a danger for that, and that's the, you know, there are speakers that you listen to, and if you've heard them once, I won't mention names, but there's one guy in particular, if you want to be entertained, go see him. There's another speaker who, if you want to be inspired and feel good about EMS and what it is you do for a living, go see him. But if you want to be educated, don't go see either one. And if you've heard one of their lectures, you've heard every single one of them, just recycled and repackaged. However, at their niche, you know, it either being inspirational or or entertaining, they are very, very good at what they do, and they get booked a lot. That plays into, I think, speakers get a following not based so much on their content, or just as much on their personality and their persona as much as their content. You read conference evaluations that, you know, people will say, you know, I'll listen to this speaker anywhere, anytime. You know, always bring this guy back. Doesn't matter what he speaks on. They're going to go listen to a certain person, not a certain topic.
You'll see that in
a lot of conferences. People will tell you, you know, I came here to hear so and so speak. Well, what's he talking on? Oh, it doesn't matter. I just love to hear him talk. Yeah.
One thing I've learned as a participant at a conference, just an attendee, is organizers should never invite someone to do a comedy act unless they've seen them before. Because yeah. I've seen some comedy acts that were so painful, they were just unbearable.
We had a EMS week event where the chief asked the chair of the EMS committee for the village to, he said, how can I help out? And he said, well, you can book the entertainment. And he booked a community belly dancing group and sort of like dismiss any sort of romantic notions that you have about belly dancing and think more like, you know, the ladies that live next door. I'm so excited to bring you this group of belly dancers. And it was like the most agonizing 15 minutes of, it was just really rough.
Would you agree? I think another thing to fit in there is that if you write a description, I think you should be accurate that you cover what you put in your presentation description.
Yep.
And the other thing is if you have 75 minutes, then you should not go over your 75 minutes. You know, you should deliver your content within the time frame that's given you.
Here's a question for you guys. Have you ever been invited as a speaker to conference and you've had to wait 10 minutes past your start time because someone else is in your room and they haven't stopped talking?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Terrible.
So far, I have only gone over once at a conference, and I went over by about 10 minutes. But it was the closing keynote speech, and it was the last lecture of the day, and I got off on a roll and went long. I got great reviews, but there were some people that said, you know, shut him up. there were probably about 10% hey, there's beer to be drunk. The toga party started 10 minutes ago.
Right.
Shut this guy up and get him off the stage.
You know, I have a comment about that. And when you give a talk, like a lot of speakers give the same talk over and over, and they might do over the years, they add stuff like, oh, here's a funny picture or here's a new piece of research, or they add stuff. And so then the number of slides, the first time they gave it was 40, and then 2 years later it was 60 slides, and 5 years later it was 110 slides. And you got to get rid of stuff whenever you add stuff, or else you just end up talking faster, and then the risk of going over. To me, it's always a big deal. I try to be crazy about the time and promising people that I finish on time. So, Kelly, I might have been one of those 10%. I'm sorry I wrote that.
I format my lectures to last 60 to 90 minutes.
Right.
And typically every lecture I have has probably 10 to 15 hidden slides in it, you know, that if someone, you know, if a conference organizer says, hey, we all our talks are 90 minutes long, can you go 90 minutes? Well, sure. It's just a matter of unmasking those slides and talking about that content, adding it in. Otherwise, I can leave it out, and it's still packaged well in a 60-minute format.
90 minutes is a long time, though. You know,
It is.
You know, as a conference organizer, that would be another piece of advice I would give people is, you know, keep the sessions to about 50 minutes, because that's stretching the attention span for most people.
Yeah.
Unless it's a really riveting workshop.
Yeah. You go to some, and some of these fairly large conferences book in 90 minute and 120 minute blocks. Now I think they offer other tracks with shorter, you know, 50 to 60 minute lectures. But I've been asked to speak at some where pretty much everything they did was at least 90 minutes long. And yeah, sometimes it's hard to fill. Other times it's not. I'm robbed times 10. I can get long winded. I don't have a problem filling time. Just give me the talking, and it's hard to get me to shut up, as you probably have discovered.
Yeah, I think a conference where it was more of a rapid fire, like, you know, 20-minute sessions, I think it'd be a good challenge as a speaker. You know, what do you really want to focus in on for that 20 minutes? And then, you know, pretty interesting for the audience of like, okay, here's your challenges. You got to, what are you going to take away from this short amount of time? You know, without a lot of sort of build up and preamble.
I'd like to see, you know, an audience with those little tools that CNN uses, you know, where you dial how you feel about the speaker and you see a graph on the wall. So,
well,
put a little pressure, you know.
You know, for the first time a couple of weeks ago, I used those audience response pads, where, each person in the audience, I could put up, I had some prepared poll questions, and that's where I asked them, you know, like, how many blogs do you read? And they could click on their answer and it would, you know, I'd display the results in it, you know, really instantaneous. Mm-hmm. And I think something like that could be pretty interesting. You know, sort of the trend line of, you know, do you like this guy, you know, yay or boo, could be pretty intimidating as a speaker to watch yourself, like, tick below the like line.
The beads of sweat start to form.
I'm trying.
Those audience response systems are great for engaging people, though.
Yeah.
I love those. I wonder at what point the novelty is going to wear off, because, you know, we don't see them a lot at conferences yet. But
Well, here's a question about...
I don't think I've lectured at an audience response system.
What's that?
I don't think I've lectured at one that had a system like what y'all are describing.
Well, I'll help you get connected with John Dillon from C3 Softworks, and he can give you the 411 on that.
Okay.
Greg, I was going to intervene there just for a second, because he talked on something, and I saw the note here on the... on the talk show about there are some conferences that do presentations that are very short and rapid fire in nature. And someone used the example, the Gathering of Eagles conference. And again, I have to tell you that I'm not a fan of that conference personally myself, but the principle of what they do at the Gathering of Eagles is these very, very short presentations, 10, 15 minutes long, rapid fire. And it just goes, you hear a lot of content within a very short period of time. The thing that sometimes is missing in their content is they lack the science to support their opinions. You can go, though, to other conferences like the Resuscitation Conference or the Society of Academic Emergency Medicine, and they have a very similar format. You'll hear abstract presentations that are not more than 10 minutes max. And I mean, that's from hello, the substance of the presentation, and then a couple of key questions from the audience, and then you move on, and they bundle them based upon a major topic area. And again, very, very powerful type of information that you can get. And then what that makes you want to do, I think, is go out and want to learn more about that particular area, so you can search out the person who gave the presentation to find out more about their research. Or in the case of like the Eagles, you can ask them, well, what are you doing more specifically in your system here? Could you tell me a little bit more about this? And so it gives you that kind of balance versus trying to present for an hour or 90 minutes. And I can tell you it is very challenging to get, because that's when you have to really use concise diction to get your point across.
Well, that would leave me out right then.
Well, the question I was going for next with we were talking about audience response pads. It's the back channel communications is what it's called. And I don't think we've really seen this in an EMS conference. But we've seen, you know, I read about it in other conferences, especially in sort of the tech world, of people during a session, you know, writing Twitter updates or interacting with other people in the audience through Twitter, or even writing in blogs or streaming the session. And it's interesting. I've gotten some pushback about like, well, you know, during a conference, we should expect people to put their cell phones away and listen. And if they're sending a text message or something, that's disrespectful, or, you know, on the other hand, it could be, well, they're instantly sharing something they've learned or thought that was funny, or they're in real time evaluating the speaker, like, this guy is great, yeah, or this gal is awful, or whatever. Anybody seeing that?
No, but I think it'd be a real killjoy if you, you know, gave someone the evil stare for using their cell phone and they were, you know, Twittering someone about what a great speaker you are. That would,
well, yeah, kill things. That's really a big risk there, right? Is, and that's kind of the place I've come to with cell phones in the classroom is, you know, why am I assuming that they're using it as a tool of evil? I mean, it might be they send that text message and it averts them being distracted for the next 20 minutes.
Yeah, I look at it the same way I do in the class, as long as it's not disrupting, you know, everyone else's experience.
Yeah. I used to include a on the objective slide of every lecture, the last bullet point was anyone caught using a cell phone will be shot and their body hung outside as an example to others. And I took that off. It always garnered a laugh, but it made my point that, you know, you turn your cell phones off. But for the same reason you were talking about, Rob, it's they're not necessarily using it as an instrument of evil. So I don't stress that so much. And you can, it's fairly easy to tell when they're distracted and not paying attention to you. All it takes is a well-placed question to the person using the cell phone. You know, and you'll know pretty soon whether they're engaged in the presentation or distracted and texting and rather than listening to what's going on. So I'm not as big a draconian about it as I used to be. I don't kind of take a laissez-faire approach to it now. Doesn't bother me that much.
I have another direction to go here, and one of the things that conference organizers say to me as well, on the evaluations, attendees always say they want more hands-on stuff. And are other people seeing good hands-on things that are working as a conference session, or what have you tried, or other thoughts on that?
I think it's smart or wise on the part of the speaker to think about props, you know, not to overuse them, but, you know, if there are props that are really appropriate, because, you know, most people are hands-on and a combination of visual and auditory learners, so you want to have examples of things that people can touch and see if they're appropriate, but you can overdo it too. So I think there's kind of a fine line between just the right number of props and overkill.
Yeah, you can, I mean, the format limits what you can do. There's only so much hands-on you can do in a 50-minute lecture. But you can break it up into something other than just a didactic speaker, you know, and passive learner thing. One of the guys speaking up here today is, at this conference, is Steve Murphy, and I listened to Steve do a couple of lectures years ago at our state EMS conference and have since plagiarized all his best stuff and used it in my classes. In his anatomy class, anatomy and physiology lecture, he'll grab someone out of the audience and draw on them with a magic marker and diagram parts of body parts with the magic marker.
Don't sit in the front.
When he does his obstetrical emergencies and childbirth talk, he does it dressed in a muumuu with curlers, you know, and a hairnet on, and, you know, he's in full drag and got a pelvic mannequin, a pelvic OB mannequin up under the thing, and he'll grab someone out of the audience and make one be a labor coach and the other one deliver the baby.
That's awesome.
And that works really well. I see a lot more conferences are starting to schedule specific hands-on workshops. Texas EMS Conference does almost one entire day of nothing but a series of 2-hour workshops. And for the past several years, I've done a presentation there called Pediatric ALS Skills, All the Stuff You're Afraid Of Plus What Actually Works. And it's a series of two-hour workshops. You do three a day, and it's about, you know, they want it to be primarily hands-on, skills-oriented stuff. So I talk for about 15 minutes, and then I break them up into skills stations for the other hour and 45, and I do that three times a day. And those are very, very popular. I've pretty much been told that, you know, I can teach that class in perpetuity, and the same people come back to it, you know, every year. So it's a pretty popular thing that other conferences would probably do well to emulate, putting like a skills workshop track in their conference schedule.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, speaking about props, I attended a conference in Richmond, Virginia years ago, and you'll appreciate this, Kelly. It was a talk on airway management. It was a great talk, but the only thing I remember from that talk was a demonstration of how to use nasal prongs to secure an endotracheal tube, making a clove hitch knot. And that was...
Oh, and that works great, too.
15, 20 years ago. And that's the only thing I remember from that conference.
Well, we don't want to talk about your memory capabilities there, Rob. But, Greg, please, we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, I was just a question in the chat room about, and this is a reminder, I guess, to listeners that you can listen live to any episode of the EMS Educast by going to emseducast.com/live Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock Central Time. You know, because of the accessibility of so many speakers now through the web, you know, we can go to Kelly's blog and read his blog posts. We can read articles he writes for EMS1.com. He posts a lot of his slides available for people to download. And then he's also does podcasts and webinars. Like, you know, what's the value, or is there a difference of seeing a speaker in person, face-to-face, when it is so easy now and almost expected that if somebody's really making a go of it on the conference circuit, that they're also going to have a strong web and social media presence?
That explains why I don't get to many conferences anymore.
I think it's, you know, to be one of the most important things to get your name out there and to get invited to speak at these conferences, you need an online presence. I don't think that just hearing you online or participating in your podcast necessarily dilutes your impact or makes you less of a draw in person. Actually, I think it does just the opposite. I don't do much podcasting compared to you or to, you know, Jamie Davis or Chris Montero. Using my book, for example, you know, I started my blog as a way to polish my writing and to advertise my book. And I put up selected stories from the book, on the blog, and my publisher just, he hated it, but he's a bit of a Luddite and he really doesn't grasp, the internet and social media at all. And he was of the opinion, hey, you know, why buy the cow when you're giving away the milk for free? But it actually increased sales quite a bit, you know, and you had a lot of people who had said that, hey, not only will I read the blog, I want to buy what you've got and I want to hold it in paper, in a book format, even though I've read it before. It's just a different experience. So I don't think that really, the fact that you podcast or actively involved in social media really dilutes your presence in person.
Yeah, you know, one of the interesting things is like, you know, I've talked to Keith Wesley about this. Like, he can give a conference presentation to have 1,000 people in the room, and nobody, he'll say, well, what questions do you have? And, you know, maybe one person will raise their hand and ask a question. And then he'll do a webinar on the same topic, and questions will just be flying in. You know, 1,000 people 300 or 400 of them will post a question during the webinar. And, you know, but then I found at conferences, you can just go up and walk up to anybody and be like, hey, I'm Greg Fries. I was in your session. Can I ask you a question? And then all of a sudden they're, you know, talking your ear off and you got a new best friend. So
it's hard yeah. to gauge whether that's a good thing or a bad thing too at the end of a talk, because sometimes, you know, I've attended talks that were so, that I was so absorbed in and learned so much and found so fascinating. At the end of it, I'm still digesting it all so much so that I just can't even think of a question. Yeah. And it was just a superb talk. So
I think that with the chance of technology coming in, we'll have opportunities now maybe to even ask questions. Why the audience could put a set of questions up that you would show up on the board behind you or on your kiosk in front of you, and they may be more willing to do that through some kind of audience response system through texting and would be more willing to do that, and you could build that time into your lecture. I think technology is going to give us some great capabilities here in the future.
Well, there are some tools already there where people can be that integrate. It's like a PowerPoint plugin that people can be sending text messages, and those will come up on the screen behind you. You can be projecting those, and talk about risky. You know, really, like anything could happen. But you know, it could be somebody.
You have to be a bit of a ringmaster to be able to manage that. But right. it's mm-hmm. I think it has huge potential. That's intriguing.
Right. Well. We're just about at the end of our only hour of this episode of the EMS Educast. Rob and then Bill and then finally to Kelly, how about a closing thought, and then we'll go through how people can connect with us.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first, Kelly, thanks again for joining us. It was another thanks. Interesting podcast. Boy, you know, the topic of conferences, I think we could probably spend 2-3 hours discussing it. I hope people on TalkShoe got something out of this. I certainly enjoyed it. And those who want to reach me, I have a blog, which is paramedictutor.wordpress.com. And speaking of conferences, I'm going to be at the National Association of EMS Educators Conference in September, and I'm hoping to do a ride out in either Chicago or Schaumburg. So if there are any listeners from Chicago or Schaumburg and you know who I might speak to do a ride out there, you can reach me on my blog or you can find me on GEMS Connect or EMS Connect.
Cool. Bill?
Oh, there I am. I have to remember my mute button. It's confusing technology, but I think that I want to encourage people that there's two things I want to talk about. If you're trying to put a conference together, I think it's important you do everything reasonably you can to vet your outside lecturers as best you can and ask them for references and feedback from other conferences that they've been to and where they've spoken. I think it's a fair thing if you're going to make an investment in them to make sure that you're getting a return on your investment. And I think that if you're really interested in getting into the speaking circuit, as I think some of the best things that you can do is start locally and continue to talk to other people and get to know people and network. And there's one other little tool I want to talk about that I think is very valuable, and Mike Tagman turned me onto it years ago. If you don't think you're a good speaker in front of an audience, become a member of Toastmasters. And it's a speaking club, and it's an excellent way for you to develop some really foundational speaking skills that I think will help you throughout your entire career and stuff. But those are my two words of wisdom, so to say, as you look for this. But you can find me on Facebook. And you can find me on Twitter at WFToon. You can send an email through the EMS Educast. Probably track me down any way that you want. I'm sure I know someone. Right, Greg?
You do, Bill. You know just about everybody, and now you know Kelly Grayson. Well, I agree with Bill's, you know, if you want to be a speaker, you got to speak more often. And because of blogs and podcasts and webinars, there's more opportunities now than there's ever been before. I want to just end my portion here before we finish up with Kelly by throwing a shout out for an upcoming session of EMSbootcamp.com that I think will be really interesting to educators, and that's Professor Joe Clark, who specializes in stroke research at the University of Cincinnati, of all places, is going to be doing a session about conducting research as an EMS student and an EMS educator. Not like a big double-blinded randomized clinical trial, but how to, you know, maybe you've got to write a research paper for class, and he'll be just delivering a brief introduction to some research and research methods and how to use scientific and medical search engines. You can join that show live April 14th if you want to take in that webinar, and emsbootcamp.com is the place to sign up for it. So go there for more. Kelly, thanks again. Final thought and how people can connect with you?
I would say that for the aspiring conference speaker, just like Bill pointed out, start small. A simple Google search can get you the conference dates and links to speaker calls for presentations at various EMS conferences. And don't be afraid to promote yourself. If you've got a topic that you're passionate about and you think you can, that other people would like to hear it, promote yourself. Cold call these guys, send out conference, fill out the speaker proposals and establish a presence on the web so that you're not so much an unknown commodity. If you have a blog or a column or a podcast that you do, by all means, make that a part of your, make sure that's prominent in your CV. And, that's often how these people are going to evaluate you and see whether you're a good fit, at their conference. And, you know, the Baxter Larmans and the Mike Smiths and the Mike Kagans, of this, world were not always the people that that everyone has heard of. Everyone had to break in at some point. So you just have to be persistent and keep plugging at it. And if people want to contact me, they can find me on my blog, ambulancedriverfiles.com, or reach me through EMS1.com. I write a regular column on there called The Ambulance Driver's Perspective. That's pretty much it. Or you can, if you're a conference organizer and you'd like to book me, you can find a list of some of my topics at kellygrayson.com with links for conference attendees and conference planners as well. And I'd like to thank you guys for having me on the podcast tonight. It was great.
Well, thanks, Kelly, for joining us, and I hope you'll tell all your blog readers about your appearance tonight, so we'll have another show race up the rankings for most listened to. We really appreciate your time and also the audience. And tell those Nebraska educators tomorrow to check out the EMS Educast. We'd really appreciate that, too.
Will do.
Thanks. This is the conclusion of this episode of the EMS Educast.